Sabrina George still interviewing Nick Wilty for New Comedy Radio. Yes, so you're talking about writing material, because I see things that are funny all the time, but I tend to storyline them rather than gag them. I make them into stories, and therefore they're too long-winded, and it's my endless struggle to actually cut it down to the chase, which is, it doesn't matter whether you're on the number 52 bus or number 53.
It really doesn't.
And just trying to get that cut down. I put everything but the kitchen sink into my gags.
You don't need to. I mean, I'll give you a good example. When I first started, I used to take newspaper cuttings on stage. So I'd all had to have a stall on stage, and I'd had all my newspaper cuttings there, and I'd pick them up and show the audience. I'd hold them up and show the audience. I don't know if you read this today in the Evening Standard, you know, like, might have only been an hour before. I don't know if you saw this story. And then I'd do my version of what tickled me, what I thought was funny about it. And then the owner of the comedy store said to me, after I'd done it three or four times, he said, you don't need to do that. If the story's true, then they know it already, because it's in the papers and it'll be on TV and they know it. If it's not true, people can't read that newspaper that you're holding up. So, it doesn't matter. If it's funny, do it. So the first time I went on stage without my newspaper cuttings was a revelation to me. I can say, oh, did you read in the paper today? There was a plane crash in Switzerland. And whether it was true or not, if a joke was valid, it would work.
It would stand on its own.
It would stand on its own. And like you say about the 52 bus or whatever, I haven't told that story yet about the call section in India.
Yeah.
But I don't need to tell them that I was on a runway for 7 hours, I was in Bournemouth, I was delayed coming back from France. They don't need all that detail. All they need is, so I overheard this woman say, and the punchline being, if you like,
I can't tell you.
Why can't you tell me? It's security. No, I'm in India.
Yeah.
You know, but see, my way of looking at it, that's a funny little story that happened in real life, right? Now, if I was telling somebody in a pub that, they'd get the full version. On stage, people aren't interested in all the bits and bobs, and then they might say, well, what were you doing in France? What, are you working there? And they, it doesn't matter. Or you might add to it and say, and the woman's saying, what's the weather like? It's about 80 degrees, you know, it's humid, it's monsoon season here, you know. And you'd make it an added joke to it, you know. So you've already established it's in India, well, why not go through with it? You know, the women tell you the whole story of what the weather's like in India.
And build it into something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then while you're on the subject, you say, yeah, I don't know if you've ever been to a monsoon country, because I was in Indonesia a couple of weeks ago and they had a bloody earthquake out there. You know, that's what you get in foreign countries. Boom. Now, I've already got into the second subject and I've wasted 20 seconds of my time. And it all makes sense. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
My best stories are all true. All true. I mean, I've got very few exceptions to the rule, but I've got some that are based on real things that obviously are not inherently funny in their own right, but they are when I exaggerate them and make them funny. But I'd rather stick to the truth. I mean, I would say 99% of what I say is true, almost verbatim, but just my take on it, that's all.
Because the other thing that comes across about you is that you're always really relaxed on stage and you always do sound like you're having a chat in the pub.
Yeah.
There's no sort of like pushing, you know, there's lots of comics that do it brilliantly, but it's that feel that you are having a chat.
Well,
and you can do that in Set Up Punch.
I'm very lucky that I didn't have a formula, because I'd never seen comedy. Before I made my debut, I'd been in one comedy club in my life. I wasn't a comedy fan, I hadn't watched telly for 8 years, so all this alternative comedy thing, whatever it is that we do, was new to me. It had all passed me by, all the, you know, the young ones, Alexis Sal, Ben Elton, all these little Robin Williams. I had not seen any of that, so I had no basis to base my act on. Any style I'd got was inherent to me. I didn't know how comedians are meant to be. The only comedians I ever seen was when I was a kid, you know, and you had, you know, I wouldn't say my wife is fat, or, you know, two blokes walk in the pub and one of them said something stupid, and I couldn't relate to it, because I live in the real world, and I went, why not say I went in the pub the other day with my mate and something happened, but that's something that's never going to happen, that I walked in with a pig. Yeah. I would never do that. Do you see what I mean? So I couldn't relate to humour at all.
You should try walking with a pig one day.
Yeah,
to
see
what
happens. Yeah. I ordered two whiskies and the barman said to me, you know, which one's with a pig? I was like, yeah.
just see what yeah. We'll try getting a chicken to cross
or
the road.
Or maybe I should marry someone just to get a mother-in-law. That's what I should do, shouldn't I?
Yeah, exactly. Build it into your repertoire. Because, again, going back to the material thing, it's something that I find kind of interesting with a lot. There's a lot of acts that I would say, I don't know, 80% of the acts are aged between, I don't know, 19 and 28.
Yes.
Yeah, and they've been true. To university and they've been great. And I'm not saying they're bad acts at all, but
not
you
so
just
no.
do feel that there is an element where they're having to pluck comedy out of thin air because they don't actually have anything within themselves that to talk about.
I can give a good example. Can I name names?
Yeah, yeah.
All in a good way, all good people. Ed Byrne.
Yeah.
Adam Bloom.
Yeah.
Tommy Tiernan. Dylan Moran. These are people who are brilliant and were brilliant in their early 20s, and then when they get to 30 something, they're running out of genuine stories because all they can do is say, oh, I was doing a gig in Kilkenny in Melbourne. They've got no stories about when
someone
I was on
said
holiday,
in the audience to me
that's it, or I remember getting this heckle once when I was. So all these stories become self-replicated because they can only talk about things they've done in their life. Now if you go on stage at 19, by the age of 30, you're a brilliant comedian, or probably before in the case of most of these guys. You're 25, you're the headliner in some fantastic comedy festival, or you're on a chat show in New York. You can't say, I used to be a truck driver, and when I was doing this, and I remember one day in the factory, because they've got no, all they can do is say, I remember at university, or when I first started doing gigs, I did my first gig in Melbourne, and do you see what I mean? And that's not a problem in itself, because all the guys I mentioned are fantastic
great
comedians.
Anyway,
they're all inherently funny anyway. That's why they're comedians. But their material has to reflect their life. And you see it in the great acts. Billy Connolly is one of the best acts that's ever lived. But because he's been famous for so long, and we know all about his life, he lives in Los Angeles, he's got a beautiful, famous wife, his friends and this, that, and that. He can't ever say, I was in a pub the other day playing dominoes with some mates of mine. We go, you weren't, Billy. You weren't. We just
what
know.
What kind of pub was it? The one that you had in your own back garden? Yeah.
Yeah. Or, you know, he can't do a joke about, you know, the worst thing about going on a night bus at 2 a.m. When were you on a night bus? Come on, mate. You know, when he worked in a welding yard in the 70s. So you lose credibility by doing it. I mean, I'm lucky that I've still got years that I haven't tapped into. I've never talked about my childhood ever on stage. I very rarely talk about girlfriends or previous. I've certainly never mentioned the army. I've got one throwaway line about the army. Well, that's 6 years of my life, including the Falklands War, that I haven't even tapped into yet. There's too much happening other than that to really talk about, you know.
And you say you sort of wander the streets sometimes with a drink in your hand. Do you? I'm not saying do that intentionally, but is that part of the process that you try and make sure that you do normal things?
No, I'm a normal person. I have a normal life.
Yeah.
My best friend in the whole world is a solicitor up in Accrington, up in the north of England. We're in the army together, and we met in Berlin. Both hated the army, bought myself out. And the way things worked out, I was going around the world a few years later. We decided to do it. We caught up in Australia. Da, da. He's my best friend in the whole world. He's not impressed one little bit by my comedy. He says, yeah, you're good, Nick, but you're just me mate. And that's how it should be. My family aren't impressed by it. It's just a job, you know. I'm not impressed by it. I think it's a good way of earning a living. I'm certainly better than doing a real job. But I don't define myself by being a comedian. I would say, and this is no modesty involved, I've always been a funny bloke, and the fact that I get paid for being funny is a double whammy for me, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't contrived that way. I didn't ever set out. Like people like Dominic Holland, Eddie Izzard, loads, there's too many to mention, Alan Davies, set out to become comedians and thought, how do I get to that position? So they did courses to learn how to do comedy. They went to drama school. They went to comedy clubs, they watched comedy, they've got stacks of videos. I had no interest in it. If I was funny, and I think I was, it was because I had things to say. I've probably made more people laugh in youth hostels around the world than I ever have on stage. You know, because that sort of bloke I am. I'll check in the youth hostel, buy a bottle of rum, start getting drunk, try and find someone to sleep with at night, and anything that comes out in conversation, if it's funny, all part of that intention is to get that girl into bed or to endear myself to people who I'm going to be spending the next 48 hours with. Why not be the funny bloke in the group, you know? And it's not contrived, it's not set out to be, that's just my nature. I've got nothing serious to say about anything. Well, I have, but I turn it into comedy, you know.
I had something just slip my mind when you were talking about, oh God, sorry, this cup's a bit, we're getting a bit windy. Yeah, because I was going to say about travelling around the world is that you still probably travel as much as you ever did.
Yeah, I'll just get paid for it now.
Now you get paid for it, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you, how do you change your material? How do you address going into a different culture with material? Do you spend a couple of days wandering around chatting to people first?
Well, in an ideal world, and this is true on 99% of all the occasions, they book me overseas, right? I find out when I'm going and I take the week off before and I say, does it affect your budget one way or the other whether I fly in a week earlier? And why would it? You know, they're going to pay for the flight anyway. What difference it makes to them whether I fly in a week before? And then I spend that week enjoying myself, having a holiday. And in the process of having that holiday, I notice things. You know, I was in Indonesia. I've been there many times, but I went there a week earlier so that I could have a holiday. I particularly wanted to go and see Mount Merapi explode, which is why I was going to Yogyakarta. That didn't work out because it involved the earthquake. So I went to Bali instead for the week. I come back to Jakarta with loads of stories about driving in Bali because I passed my driving test last year. So now I'm going back to places I've been before and I'm driving. So I've got 10 minutes stuff out what it's like to drive in a third world country. I've been in dozens of third world countries, but always got public transport. Now I know what it's like to be a driver in a third world country and it makes me laugh. So that's how I do it. I mean, I've just been working on cruise ships most of the summer. Every time I'm in the UK, I fly off somewhere. I got back from Lisbon the other night. Where am I going next week? Oh, somewhere like bloody Naples or something. I've been on four different cruise ships. Now, they're the most tedious place on earth if you're at sea, because you just eat luxury food and, you know, as a friend of mine, Windsor, said, it's like being in prison with smoked salmon. It really is tedious. But if you live the life of a passenger, which I do, I use the jacuzzi, the swimming pool, the cinema, and the moment they pull in dock, I'm out of there, mate. You know, I'm ashore. I did the Caribbean a few months ago. I get a motorbike at 8 o'clock in the morning. I say, what is the last time you want me on ship? And they go, we'll sail at 6, or quarter to 6, I'll be here on the gangway. And I don't make myself known to the passengers at all. I've got no interest in befriending them, you know. I just want to have fun. Then I'll do my show, and half of what I'm talking about is what I've done that day. I say, you know what, we all went ashore today in Barbados, didn't we? Did anyone go up to such and such beach? Or, you know, if you hire a car and you drive about 20 miles, you might find the most beautiful rum distillery and you get free drinks. And people go, oh, wow, well, we didn't know that. We thought you had to sort of hang around the port. Well, no, you don't. So not only am I having fun and writing material,
you're acting as a surrogate.
I'm saying, yeah, next time you're here, don't sit around in Carlisle Bay in Barbados. It's beautiful, but there's going to be loads and loads of beautiful beaches. Get out, go up the north of the island, go and see the caves, you know. You can do these fantastic Tarzan swings through these caves, you know. That's what you want to be doing on holiday, isn't it? And if I spot some of the passengers, you know, on the day trips, I don't tell them who I am, but that night on stage, I say, is there a Scouse bloke in here who went on the rope swing today? I did, oh, right. You're the guy who shouted out, get me out of here, I want to be a celebrity, and it suddenly gets a big laugh,
yeah.
And everybody says, oh, right, oh, he's like one of us, he's actually
joining
on holiday.
In, yeah.
Now, the last couple of weeks have been a bit awkward, because I've had a broken leg for 6 weeks, so working on cruise ships has been a bit of a pain, really, to be honest, but I try to have as much fun as I can in life, and if you get paid to go somewhere nice, make the most of it. And I mean, I could name names of very famous comedians, very nice people that I've worked with in, say, Melbourne or San Francisco or wherever, Cape Town, that fly in, do the shows, fly home again. Don't go on safari, don't go out to the outback, don't visit islands. What is the point, you know? Why bother?
Missing out on some of the best perks of the job.
The perk of the
job. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So what about something like Shanghai? I would expect you would be hired because you're going to have a primarily British or English-speaking audience.
English-speaking, yeah. It's expats of different nationalities. So it'll be French, maybe German, then you'll get the Canadians, Australians. But they know it's English comedy. If you don't speak good English, don't come along. It's as simple as that. Now, you can get away with what you do in the clubs here because they're well-read, you know, they're businessmen. You can talk about Tony Blair, George Bush. You could probably even, at a push, get away with... So, how many people are from London, yeah, and how many been to London? If you wanted to, be pretty lame and get away with jokes about the congestion charges or Ken Livingstone, which are London, if that's what you want to do. But why not do what I did? I went out there the last time with Mick Ferry, who's a great mate of mine from Manchester. Go there... and then persuade him to come on holiday with me. And we go to a little, like the Chinese Venice, and we get boats, and we meet local people, and we eat local food. And Mick, who's, you know, generally talks about Manchester and Oldham and whatever, suddenly comes back to Shanghai with all these great stories about, we went to this village in China, and there was this, that, and it opened up a whole new vista for him as well. And then after the gigs were over, I went on that 10-day climbing mountains in the middle of China and did all the sort of bits of China that I'd seen on plates, you know what I mean? I've got this idea of what China should look like, and Shanghai don't look like it. So I literally got a picture off the internet of this place I wanted to go, with these sort of very pointy little mountains and lakes and whatever, and people fishing with cormorants. And I went to a travel agent and said, well, I want to go there. They said, oh, it's very difficult to get to. Well, I appreciate that. That's why I want to go there. How do I get there? So I fly to this place called Guilin, in the middle of China. Then I spend 4 hours on a boat going downriver. And then get off in this place called Yangshao. And lo and behold, check in a sort of a youth hostel. And the view that I'm looking at matches the postcard that I got off the internet. To me, that is what life's all about. And... all right, I did spend a lot of money. It's a cheap place, but I spent about half of what I'd earned. But I come back to England with all these brilliant memories and videos and photos of the place I've been, and a few jokes about it, and a suntan. And then I run into Mick, and I sent him a DVD of what I'd been up to. And he went, do you know, next time I go there, I'm going to have holiday with you. He said, because you know what you're doing. And I hope he does. And then I decided, I did Shanghai another time with James Dowdeswell.
Lovely guy.
Couldn't get him to leave Shanghai. You know, I wanted to show him China. You know, go places, see things. Before that, I went out there with Incognito, and again, he just wanted to sit in the bars in Shanghai and get drunk and whatever. And at that point, I wasn't drinking, admittedly, so that side of it bored me. But I managed to coerce him to come into this place, Surfco.
Can I just say, for those who don't know, Incognito is notoriously full-on, aggressive, loud comic.
Yeah, he's a fantastic comedian and a lovely bloke, but a raging, full-on...
loony on stage.
Yeah, full-on loony and off-stage, giving the right amount of alcohol, yeah.
So what happened with you and him in Shanghai?
Well, we went to this fantastic... it was monsoon season, so it was raining everywhere, it didn't matter where we went. So I said, look, let's go inland. We went to this place called Ganzhou, I think it's called. Only, you know, a couple of hours outside of Shanghai. I had my best mate Martin with me, the guy who's here.
From Manchester.
Solicitor. And the three of us went to this obscure little place, middle of nowhere in the monsoon, where nobody spoke English, there were no signs in English. And because we arrived very early morning, and I mean, I'm fussy about what I eat anyway, but you couldn't read the menus to find out what you're eating. So we basically were looking for things we recognised, so you could point at things and say, I'll have one of them, but we didn't recognise anything. So we're all starving. Anyway, Cognito's much more outgoing than me, and certainly in terms of eating. And we kept seeing these things hanging up in windows that looked like sort of varnished handbags wrapped in plastic. They're obviously food of some description, but you wouldn't have a clue what they were. And that was what was everywhere. We couldn't see it. There's no bread, couldn't even see rice, you know. So eventually Cognito said, well, I'm just going to have one of them. I said, well, you don't even know what it is. I don't know, but I'm starving. So Martin said, well, I'll give it a go as well. And I went, well, I used to be vegetarian. I'm still a bit fussy now, so I ain't going to. And it, sort of, this thing's wrapped in cellophane. You open it up, and it was an ox's hoof. You know, and there's obviously, like, the heel of...
ox.
An ox's hoof with the heel behind it. And the idea is, you know, you sort of peel off this thing and eat it like, sort of, like dried... what do we call it from now in South Africa?
Biltong.
That's basically what this varnished ox's hoof is sort of built on. It's been hanging there so long that it's
dried.
It's dried, and you peel it off, and it's sort of like this stringy, meaty thing. Well, I starve all day. I can't eat muck like that, you know. So, but we, you know, we paid to have like this 80-year-old woman sing for us. The most appalling sound you ever heard, like a cat being strangled. But it's her only income. It's part of experience, you know. And we sat in this bar in the monsoon, looked out, and as far as you could see was lakes and rivers and people fishing and people going about their business, and not a single white face. Now, to me, that's what China should be like. Not a, you know, a sort of a New York mock-up, which is what Shanghai, a massive great city full of international businessmen and fast cars and mobile phones, you know. You're not seeing China. So James, I love the bloke to bits. All he saw was, you know, another big city where they spoke foreign. But there's McDonald's and Starbucks and all the comforts of home and, you know, well, you know, I won't say Watney's Red Barrel, but, you know, all the sort of, you know, Carlsberg Lager and Marlboro cigarettes. He didn't see China. And then he does the show playing to people who are all white faces, all speak English. And then we went, you know, we were hanging out in, like, the French embassy club, meeting nice white girls. And, you know, it just wasn't...
It wasn't an experience.
Why
yeah.
go to China and hang out with white people?
But this goes back to the other areas. What I don't know, curiosity stroke courage or something. It's like to be a comic. One of the things that I'm constantly asked is, "Oh, you must be so brave. Oh God, that would terrify me. That must be so scary." And to be honest, in the beginning, it was terrifying. But then, that is not what terrifies me. In fact, very little really terrifies me. It's more, you know, is this material going to work? It's a sort of mild nervousness, a sort of tension.
Good.
And I hope it's good. But I find the same with, I have the same thing about travelling. I love travelling and I love going to, you know, off-road stuff. And I think that there are a lot of comics who, for want of a better term, play safe with what they know, what they can do. And trying to punt out into an area of either comedy or, in a geographical sense, go somewhere else, there is a correlation between the two. People
there definitely is, yeah. I mean, I look at it, I mean, my debut on stage in Canada, I'd never been so nervous in my life. I mean, I weed myself with fright. I literally, as they announced my name, it trickled down my leg, right? Now, I was thinking on my feet, I had a pint of lager in my hand, so what I did was a comedy fall, if you like, as it went through the curtain, and spilt the lager over my trousers, so it got a laugh from the audience, because I'm an idiot, and it literally covered my tracks. But the moment the lights were there in my face, my opening thing I ever said on stage, is this it? What? I stand here and talk to you, listen, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this. This is it. And somebody went, tell a joke. I went, no, I'm not worried about jokes. I can't believe it. I'll just stand here and you listen and I'd, wow. Oh, I'm going to be good at this. And that was my first minute on stage. So for me, I treat travelling, I treat comedy the same way as I used to treat parachuting. Prepare. You know, in the army, we pack our own parachutes, right? You're about to do a jump. If it don't work, it's your fault. You packed it. You told how to do it and it's inspected, sure. But you packed it. Now, if I pull that cord and it don't open, all I can do is, you know, laugh,
say,
scream.
Say, what a bloody idiot, you go down.
Yeah, what an idiot. I love you, mum, bye. You know, that's it. It's your own bloody fault. And I treat comedy like that, like a parachute jump. If I'm not nervous, I try and get nervous before I go on. I don't know if you've seen me enough times, but 5 minutes before I go on, I have to get a little bit of space on my own. I pace around, and what I normally say to myself, I've got no bloody jokes. It's not going to hate. I've got nothing to say to them. This is a nightmare. I shouldn't be here. This is pathetic. What was I think? Then, of course, they say, are you ready for Nick Wilty? I step through the curtain and go, hello. Oh, hello. Yeah, I know. Yeah, lights are on, sounds on. Oh, I know what I'm here for. I know what you want. You're looking at me to want me to tell jokes. But I keep that bit to myself, by the way. I don't tell them that.
Yeah.
And that's how I was with parachuting in the army. Prepare. Do everything as best you can. Now, don't hope for the best. You're giving yourself a 99% chance for working, aren't you? You've done all the preparation. Now's your big deal. So even recently I did a parachute jump in South Africa with Martin Davis, another comedian. And just before I left the aircraft, I go through that whole self-doubt thing. Oh my God, this is horrendous. What am I thinking? I haven't done this for 20 years. What am I thinking? This is stupid. And the moment I say go, I go, yeah, absolutely, bye. jump out and I'm relaxed as anything. Yeah, I know exactly what I'm doing. Pull my chute open, boom, floating down over the beautiful scenery of Cape Town. This is what I'm here for, you know. And that's how I treat my comedy. And that's why I still get a buzz out of it after 15 years. I love it out there. But I get nervous, and I make myself nervous because it's important. I want to do a good show
It's a particular type of nerves. Because my favourite gigs are ones where I've gone on prepared, as you say, with a certain set, but then something has happened.
Yes, definitely.
And I felt completely, it is like the parachute in the sense that I've come completely free to leave my set. Yeah. And sometimes not even come back to it, but knowing I can, if what I've left isn't going on. Those are my favourites.
Oh, the greatest gigs on earth are where you do new material, you ad-lib something that's equally of the quality that you've written. And I mean, I'll give you an example. This weekend I was in Glasgow, and I won't mention this guy's name because it's not very nice, but he's comparing a show in Glasgow, and he said that there was a whole party of Asian girls on a hen night, very young and pretty. And he said something using the Paki word, right? And they immediately got up, walked out, wanted their money back. He didn't see he'd done anything wrong. He's saying, I pick on old people, young people, I picked on these guys, hip-hop guys, he said, I'm having a go at Scottish people. But anyway, these women really got annoyed, so all of them demanded their money back. They got given their money back, they left all their drinks behind, so they got refunded for the drinks, you know. Everyone's apologetic. And I'm the next act on. And there's, two empty tables at the front because of him. Now, you want to refer to it, but you think you've got to beat around the bush a little bit. So I got on with my act, and at the end, I've had a really good show, and I just said, I've enjoyed myself here. I said, but I'm a little bit annoyed because I ordered 16 Asian girls and haven't turned up. Now, it got a huge laugh to the point of some people choking on me, but you can't say that. No, I can. Yes, I can. It's funny. And the first half of my set was all about me and Aisha.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it relates, not
it
only does
it
relate,
into context.
It all came into context. And the compere, who shall remain nameless, said to me afterwards, he said, that's a sign of a class act. You didn't refer to it right till the end, he said, and then you made a succinct point, they had a go at me, made yourself look all right, and made the audience laugh. He said, and they weren't here to be offended. So, you know.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
the biggest joy, isn't it?
Yeah,
when you come up with something spontaneously.
Yeah.
And all the way through myself, I think, I've got to mention these empty tables, but I don't know what to say, you know. And it just occurred to me, just say that at the end and boomf, you know.
You're away and running.
Mm. Another time, one of my best shows ever was in a club that's been and gone now, called The Cartoon in Clapham in South London. And it was quite a high pressure gig in as much as it was packed solid. And they book the best acts, you know, you get people doubling up from the Comedy Store. So you might be on with Jack D, Lee Evans, people like that. And because they're doubling up, they might have to go on first. And suddenly you find yourself, you're the new act, and you're closing after someone like Lee Evans or Eddie Izzard. And you think, oh my God, you know, what a nightmare. But the reality is, the audience presume
that you're even better.
You must be better than them, or they wouldn't put you on there. They don't know the ins and outs. In fact, the only reason you're on is because they're really busy, because they're really good acts and they've got three other shows to do, and you're the only one who's not doubling up. So I remember this one night, I think I'd followed Jack D, and he'd done something about the drought in Kent, right, which is where I'm from, and I thought, oh no, I've got loads of stuff about the drought. Damn, I've got to cut out of that material. So what I did, I started on something else, rearranged my set, and then about halfway through I said, yeah, I live in Kent, you know. I said, you know, Jack was talking about the drought. That's true, that is. And then did my version of a joke, and not only did it work really well, because they think, oh, right, oh, he knows Jack as well. And he's referring back. And then the reason I was so proud, the compere was Sean Mio. And he knew I'd had one of them really, really good shows, but I was a new act. And I think he was being a little bit sort of competitive or spiteful. He gave me an encore, which I did, and that was fine. And then he said, do you want to hear more? Gave me another encore. Now, I know Sean very well. We're great friends. But I know what was going on there. He's going, you're going to run out of material in a minute. So he gave me another encore. The third encore, I really generally had nothing to say. And I came out and there was a shelf on stage. It was one of these, it was like a big pub rather than a proper comedy club. And it had a shelf that stuck out onto the stage where people put their beer. So I just said, Sean went, get out of that. I went, right, hello, yeah, it's me again. Oh, I do like a shelf. Well, I'm a bloke, also like shelves, you know what you're getting. That's why women like cupboards. It's all that mystique. We don't want to know what's in there, they do. And I just improvised this routine for about 5 minutes, and I got off and I got a pat on the back from Sean, and unbeknownst to me, everybody in there knew that I was the same sort of, they realised what was going on, and it was just, yeah, that last 5 minutes was made up on the spot. It was funny, it was improvised, and what happened is that it worked so well that I kept it in after that. If I was in a club that had a shelf, I'd go, oh, thank God, there's a shelf. Oh, I do like a shelf. Well, I'm a bloke, of course I like shelves. And then the routine built up, and I started talking about why women like cupboards and closets, and we like sheds. But the only thing about sheds is that you don't know how to build them, and you know, and it just, that's what I'm proudest of. When things like that happen, you have no choice. What was I going
to
say?
You're forced to show your true self.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, one thing I've done once in my life, and I will never ever do again, hopefully, is when you're on, say, your third encore or something, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but it happens once in the blue moon, and you've got nothing to say. Only once did I repeat somebody else's joke, but I gave them credit for it. I said, look, I've got nothing more to say, I really haven't. But I tell you what, my favourite joke of all time, and I quoted a Rich Hall joke, a one-line joke. I just said, now, if I could write a joke like that, I would have done it now, but I haven't. Look, thank you very much for listening. And the only way I'd justify it, this was only about a month ago, I'd already done 2 one-and-a-half-hour shows, and I went to do the third show, and it was the same audience again, and I just didn't know what to say to them. I threw together some bits and bobs. I could not think of any more to say. Everything that I wanted to say, I'm like, right, no, I did that the other night, didn't I? And that, oh God, I did that as well, didn't I? Oh, I mean, yeah, I've done, and I just didn't know what to say, so I just said, I'm just going now on my favourite joke. I didn't write it, a guy called Rich Hall wrote it, and I just want you to know, he's one of the best comedians.
What was the joke?
It was the joke about, you know, monkeys. Do you know the one?
No.
He said, you know, they say we're descended from monkeys. Well, how come there's still monkeys? You know, and in Indonesia, where monkeys sort of roam the streets, it's quite a funny thing. And to me, that is just, it's almost profound, it's that funny. Yeah, if we're descended from monkeys, how come there's still monkeys? So I got off on telling Rich Hall's joke, which I hope I never have to do again, but like I said, it was exceptional circumstances. I knew they liked me, but I didn't expect them to come back on the third night. You know, you do an hour and a half show. Oh, that was one of the best nights of my life. Next night, oh my God, same audience. Third night, I really thought, no. I don't know who you think I am. I just have not got 4.5 hours of material. I just haven't. I don't care. I think, you know, even greatest acts on earth, Ross Nobles, you Eddie Izzard, you know. Joe Graham would struggle to come up with over 3 hours of solid material, and I said, look, I'm going to have to cut this short. I honestly have run out of things to say to you. And I did all the new stuff I'd written, I'm thinking on my feet, oh, what else have I noticed? Oh, now I started sort of digging in the archives, you know, oh, blimey. How many English people were you around when John Major was around? Oh, what an idiot he was, wasn't he? You know, desperation, talking about the first Gulf War, you know, George Bush Senior. And I just, I've honestly run out of things to say to you. I really have.
Going back to medieval times.
Yeah, well, it felt like it, yeah.